Hello and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I am your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you. The Answers for Cancers podcast is sponsored by Care Plus Pharmacy. Care Plus Pharmacy is Ireland's leading community pharmacy brand, offering expert advice and services for a healthier and happier you. Find your nearest Care Plus on www.careplus.ie or follow them on social media for health and wellness inspiration and tips.
Naomi Algeo is an occupational therapist who has worked both publicly and privately, both in the UK and in Ireland, with a keen interest in cancer care, so much so that she is currently undertaking a PhD at Trinity College Dublin in the area of the Working Cancer Programme. She also facilitates a number of workshops across cancer support centres in Ireland, covering topics such as returning to work and cancer-related fatigue. She joins us today to talk about returning to work after a cancer diagnosis and what entitlements a person is eligible for. Thank you so much, Naomi, for joining us on the podcast. We know that this is going to help so many people. Enjoy.
So, Naomi, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to us today about a really important topic. And as we were just saying there before we started, something that I just don't think is discussed enough. So thank you for speaking to us about navigating work with a cancer diagnosis. I think it's really important. One thing that myself and Anne-Marie have realized in starting the podcast is the incredibly important role that occupational therapists play with patients with a cancer diagnosis. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and your interest in this area?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for having me. So I suppose for anyone who's not familiar with the role of an occupational therapist or an OT, we look at someone's function. So particularly if somebody's been impacted by an illness such as cancer, an injury or an impairment. So we often associate the words activities of daily living with OTs. So really we're looking at people's independence in things like their self-care. So can they wash themselves, dress, cook, shop, drive? We look at their productivity. So can they go to work? Can they go to school or, you know, engage in education if that's what they're doing, as well as leisure. So looking at their participation and interests and activities that they get meaning out of, or I suppose quality of life. So I started working as an OT in London a number of years ago, and I started with a few different rotations, but it was really during my time in adult oncology services at UCL Hospital in central London that I really knew it was the role for me, I suppose. You know, the role is quite broad. So a typical day might involve educating patients on how to manage things like cancer-related fatigue or cognitive changes. So we often hear of that kind of fogginess or that chemo brain that people talk about. We also associate OTs with equipment sometimes. So I would prescribe equipment, certain items, if it means that somebody is able to complete a task independently then, or if they can, you know, do more of the task themselves. And I suppose we'd also often look at things like people's home setup and look, is it safe for them to go home? Can we put a few things in place to transition from the home to from the hospital setting rather to the home? So I suppose it was also during that time that I came to realize that there was a distinct lack of resources in the area of cancer and employment. So I mentioned OT's work and productivity. Long story short, I'm now finishing up my PhD at Trinity College in the area of, we've just developed what we call the Working Cancer Programme, and we've just tested it out to see if people think it's any good or what should we change about the programme. So I suppose that's the research side of things, but I would also facilitate a number of workshops across cancer support centres in Ireland. So more recently online, but in the areas of return to work, managing cancer-related fatigue, as well as managing other symptoms, so such as cognitive changes, breathlessness, lymphedema, pain, amongst others, things that can really impact on day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Like myself, Michelle, had a conversation about this. I suppose it's something that is brought up an awful lot with our patients, but we just don't have the answer. So we're so delighted to have you here today. And I think especially when you get a cancer diagnosis, you're so can be so tunnel visioned on the treatment and the plan and what you have to do, and then all of a sudden you're going back to work and there was never really a thought about it. So it can sometimes be a bit of a panic, you know, that way. So I suppose, if you don't mind, would you mind telling us a little bit about a person's employment rights and I suppose the entitlements that they have in context of a cancer diagnosis?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose a quick disclaimer, I am not a qualified solicitor. However, I do come across the following items as part of my day-to-day research roles and my clinical role. So I think we'll start off broad and we look at the definition of disability. So under the Disability Act in Ireland, a disability is seen as a restriction in someone's capacity. So that could be because of maybe a physical impairment, a mental or an emotional impairment, a sensory, an intellectual, a cognitive impairment, so our thinking skills. And I suppose what a lot of people don't realise is that anyone living with or beyond a cancer diagnosis in Ireland is considered to have a disability, even if they no longer have that cancer diagnosis, so for the rest of their life. And people are often very surprised by this if they didn't know that, but it's actually there to protect you. Mm-hmm. So some of the protective, I suppose, entitlements or rights that are out there include reasonable accommodations. So some people might have heard of reasonable accommodations before. And a reasonable accommodation is a change to the tasks that you do in your job role, or to maybe what your job looks like or your workplace, which enables somebody with a disability to be able to complete their job role and to basically enjoy equal opportunities. There's two caveats to that. Number one, your employer is not at fault if they don't know that you have the restriction in the first place. And I'm sure we'll touch on communication later on, but we would really, you know, you don't have to tell your employer everything, but we certainly encourage some form of communication there, because really it's in the long term, it's really going to help you transition back into your work role. The second caveat is that under EU law, the accommodation needs to be reasonable, hence the reasonable accommodation. So it can't be excessive to the employer. So that kind of begs the question, well, what does a reasonable accommodation look like? I suppose some of the most common ones that we would see or recommend might be that phased return to work, which sometimes is known as a graded return, and I'm sure we'll touch on that again later. Working from home. Previously, that is seen as a reasonable accommodation, but we might have heard in the news recently that they're looking to bring in further legislation to make that a right for everybody, so not just those with a disability. Flexibility in working hours, changes to your work environment, whether that's looking at, you know, your chair and your desk, moving shelving, things like that. Technology to support any impairment. So an example of that might be, I had a lady a few weeks ago who we were sorting out speech to text technology. As part of her role, she'd write a lot of reports, but she was so fatigued that actually getting this technology in place meant that she could just speak out loud to the report and it would write it for her. So things like that, or even a change in the job description. Now that's usually more of the last resort type of accommodations, because ultimately we want to get people back into their role. I suppose something that we have found from our research though as well is that very often people find it difficult to position themselves in reasonable accommodations. So they often think of reasonable accommodations in the form of maybe physical impairment. Whereas if we think about the reasonable accommodations we just touched on, a lot of those are can help facilitate things like fatigue, things like maybe cognitive changes. So things that we don't often see, the side effects that are maybe a bit more invisible. So reasonable accommodations are for everybody. A thing to note in terms of facilitating reasonable accommodations, obviously it can involve a bit of cost for the employer. So some people in the private sector, or maybe if they're self-employed, might be a bit hesitant about, well, how do I go and put my hand up and ask for something like this? I do think it's important there for people to know that if you're in the private sector or self-employed, there is the Workplace Equipment Adaptation Grant. And that is assistance for employers, employees and the self-employed who need to adapt the workplace or maybe purchase some type of equipment, whether that's that chair I was talking about, the desk, maybe it's assistive technology. And it's for staff with a disability. So hence, again, why the term disability has that protection for people. I think the maximum grant is just over 6,000 euro, but you can definitely look more. I think on Citizens Information should give you a little bit more about that. I'm sure lots of public sector employees are now saying, well, what about us? So if you are a public sector employee, your employer must make reasonable accommodations available through their own resources. So that's how that works there. So that's just one grant to be aware of. I think one of the most powerful benefits that I've come across is the partial capacity benefit. And it's a social welfare scheme that allows you to return to work if you have restrictions in your capacity, hence the partial capacity, but to continue to receive a payment from the Department of Employment Affairs and Social Protection. So there's a few eligibility criteria, but you need to have been claiming illness benefit for at least 6 months or the invalidity pension. You need to have your restrictions on your capacity assessed. So it needs to fall under either a moderate restriction, severe or profound. Mild doesn't qualify. And you must receive written approval before you return to work to get the payment. I think the benefit is reviewed about every 3 years, and obviously to go and check if these things can change over time. But an example of a payment would be that if you fell under a moderate restriction, and again, we can't be thinking just physical impairment, you could have a moderate restriction because of fatigue, because of anxiety, because of cognitive changes. If you had a moderate restriction under that scheme, and you'd previously be getting the illness benefit, for example, you'd receive over 100 euro a week, regardless of the hours you work and regardless of your earnings, which is important to note. So that extra 400 euro could mean that you could do something like a phased return to work. Mm-hmm. We know in the recent Irish Cancer Society report that a lot of people who return to work a bit too early because of the financial pressure. So this is a benefit that might be able to help relieve some of the financial pressure. So that's a partial capacity benefit. The final piece on the entitlements and the rights. A lot of people ask, am I entitled to sick leave, paid sick leave? Mm. The short answer is no. Ireland is one of the few countries in the EU where the employer isn't obliged to provide payment during sick leave. But I think you might have heard in the news recently that they're going through a consultation process at the minute to try and change that, which is promising. What I would say to you is if you are on sick leave, do check your contract. So number one, check if you're entitled to payment during sick leave. Number two, if you are, is there a cap on the time in which you can receive it? Is it for a certain period of time? And number three, is there a percentage of your pay that you'd receive? So does this decrease over time? So it's just little things to be aware of when you're planning your return to work from a financial point of view.
Gosh, these are brilliant. I didn't know any of these existed.
Yeah.
The one that you were speaking about previously where people need the assessment, whether they're mild, moderate or severe, is it an occupational therapist that does this assessment for them? Is it?
So an occupational therapist can input into the assessment, but you would go through your GP typically. Mm-hmm. So the really important thing is it has to be approved in full. It can't just be submitted. It needs to be approved before you return to work. If you return to work, it's too late. You won't get the payment. So that's the one thing. And a lot of people don't know about it and they hear about it too late. Mm-hmm. They've already gone back to the workplace, someone says, oh, did you get the partial capacity benefit? Mm. And, you know, the time is gone. So I would shout about the partial capacity benefit to everybody.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah, for sure. And can I just clarify, you did say about anybody with a cancer diagnosis, I suppose, is deemed to have a disability of some sort. That's not just for anybody living with cancer, say metastatic cancer. That's anybody, even if you have a curative cancer and you finish treatment. Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Wow.
Yeah, be completely cancer-free. Mm. As long as you have had a cancer diagnosis, you are considered to have a disability. And I think it really feeds into those chronic side effects that a lot of people don't realize. Because they,
you know, like you can be, I suppose, cured, but the psychological impact of that can last for years.
Yeah.
So it's really good to know. I suppose oftentimes also a person's work environment may need to be adapted. I know you mentioned that in what you said previously. Would you be able to just talk us through the importance of ergonomics and how people can go about implementing this into their workplace?
Yeah, absolutely. So ergonomics is the study of people in their working environment. So we often think of things like ergonomic chairs and desks and shelving and things like that. So I suppose in general, we think of maybe more desk-based roles when we first think of it. But I'll give you a few principles to think through. So if we consider that general office-based role, and we're talking, I'm sitting at a desk, for example. So the first principle is to work in a neutral position. And this is where, if I'm ever in a face-to-face workshop or I can see people on the Zoom screen, everyone starts to shuffle and starts to sit up straight, because we talk about that principle of the 90-90-90, and that's 90 degrees, so that your back is straight, your upper legs are at that 90 degree angle to your back, and then your knees are falling down at another 90 degree angle. So really looking at the neutral position. I suppose when we're in sitting, over time, our shoulders tend to start to bunch forward a little bit. We kind of start to, go into that position that we're moving forward. Our back goes into a little bit of an S curve. Mm-hmm. So I want you to imagine maybe a string pulling from the top of your head, and it's keeping you upright, and to keep that position. Another thing, and it's even more common now, well, from what I've heard anecdotally during the pandemic, is considering your neck and the position of the screen. So at the moment, I'm on the laptop, but you can't see it, but it's actually on top of a shoebox on the desk. So it's at that eye level. If you were to look at my side profile, I'm looking straight. Whereas if I took away that shoebox, I'd be looking down. And if you're working at a screen or a computer for so many hours, a lot of people have got, you know, this new neck and shoulder pain that they haven't had before, because we're at computers so much more. There's so much more screen time. So considering the eye level of your screen. Movement breaks. Everyone needs to take movement breaks. So if you are sitting static, you should be taking a really quick movement break every 30 minutes. So that involves rolling those shoulders, gentle neck stretches, getting up off the chair and shaking your legs a bit. People don't do it enough, and people say, oh, but I forget. So whether it's something like putting a post-it on your screen saying movement break, something like that, putting in your diary in between meetings. The other thing we mentioned about ergonomic chairs, I suppose I often hear people come to me and they say, oh, I got an ergonomic chair, it's wonderful. But, you know, an ergonomic chair for someone who is 6 foot is not going to be the same for somebody who's 5 foot, for example. So there's lots of things you need to consider. You might have an ergonomic chair, but it mightn't be set up for your needs. So it should be height adjustable. So ask yourself, are my feet firmly on the floor? Am I at that 90-90-90 degree angle? Is my bum at the back of the chair? Sometimes the seats have a sliding adjustable feature that you can make sure your bottom is tucked up at the very back of the chair, but your feet are still firm on the floor. And are the armrests adjustable? So if the armrests are too high, your shoulders are going to bunch up, and that's going to cause pain in your shoulders and your neck. If it's too low, you're not being supported. So it's little things like that. Another principle is keeping everything in reach. So we're trying to
add up, isn't it? Sorry, I'm interrupting you, but I was just saying, when you say they're little things, but all of these little things accumulate, don't they? And then they can all add up to do something that's a bit more severe. So it's great.
Yeah, exactly. And I think really the pandemic has shown that as well, with, say, for example, that neck and shoulder pain. A lot of people are presenting now who hadn't presented before with that pain, and it was just that small thing of their setup. Yeah. The second principle, keeping everything in reach. So we want to avoid excessive bending, reaching, twisting, lifting. If you're in a sitting position and you put your arms out straight and then move them to your side, it's in that area that we want to keep the items that we use most frequently. Mm-hmm. So anything that you need to bend forward for or twist to the side for should be a less used item. So just keeping things close at reach to avoid that kind of bending and reaching. If you're in standing, think of items at three different levels. So above shoulder level, between the shoulder and the waist, and then below the waist. It would kind of make sense that we would store maybe our more commonly used items in our neutral position, so between our shoulders and our waist, because that's easier to get. Items above the shoulder level should be a bit more lightweight. So if you're in an office and there's a big box of books or something, or folders that you need to lift down, it's much more dangerous than if you were to lift them from a lower position, for example. So try and keep things above shoulder level a bit more lightweight. Anything then below the waist, less frequently used items again, and maybe the more heavier items. Keeping items used together in proximity. I always use the tea and coffee example. We always try and keep the tea beside the kettle and maybe our mug and our spoon, whatever. The same thing applies to work. So whether it's keeping the spare paper and the stapler by the printer, keeping items that are commonly used together like that. And that's it really in terms of the ergonomic main principles. If you did have maybe a bit more complex issues from a physical point of view, and you wanted to, get assessed for an ergonomic chair, I'd certainly link in about getting an assessment from an OT.
Brilliant. I think this is actually going to help so many people, not just people who are listening to this for cancer, but I think anybody. I'm looking at my chair over there now and I'm like, can't wait to sit in it and see everything's in my reach. So I suppose moving on from that, and thank you, that's really, really practical information for people. Have you some suggestions to help people take control of their return to work and how they can communicate with their employer and their colleagues? I know sometimes this can be quite difficult for people.
Yeah, and I suppose from the first things first, from a communications point of view, the most important thing to do is to keep in touch with your employer. Mm. We know that having regular contact with an employer throughout your sick leave period actually helps facilitate a more successful return to work. Mm-hmm. But there does have to be balance with that, because if there's too much communication, particularly one way from the employer, that can induce a bit of pressure on somebody. So what I would always say is you set the expectations. So you agree on the terms of that level of contact. So for example, you can say, hi, Michelle. Michelle's my boss. Hi, Michelle. You know, I've got a medical cert for X amount of months. I'm intending to email you once a month at the start, the first week of every month, to give you a quick update. Mm-hmm. And that way you've set the terms, you send the email, and at least they know that something is going to be coming from you. And it doesn't have to be, it could be every 2 weeks, every month. It could be, I'll get back to you in 2 months' time. Mm-hmm. Wherever you're at that time, you set the terms. I'd also suggest keeping a link with colleagues if you can. It's a bit like the longer we are out of, you know, our job role, the more anxiety can build, you know, it just builds up and up. It's like not texting a friend back. And after 1 week, you think, oh, gosh, I can't. No. It's been too long now. So just, I suppose, really keeping a link, if you can, whether it's a quick text to one colleague or something like that, I'd definitely set a goal for that if you can. You then get to the stage that you're starting to really consider your return to work. Mm. So, you know, maybe you've got through most of the active treatment and you're trying to think about what that might look like. So you need to start thinking about approaching your employer. So it's not just the update. It's, okay, well, actually, maybe we should have a meeting. So there's a few things you can consider before a meeting, during a meeting and after a meeting. What I'd say is before, make a bullet point list of all the items you want to cover. So you might want to ask things like, how much notice do I need to give before I go back to work? Mm. Would a phased return be facilitated? And if it would that impact on my pay and benefits? Mm-hmm. Hence why a partial capacity benefit could be really helpful there, mm-hmm. if you are impacted financially by a phased return. What kind of flexible working arrangements are available, if they are available? Medical appointments, that's a really frequently asked question. So what's the policy about medical appointments, mm-hmm. You know, with this company? And maybe, you know, another commonly asked question that the people mentioned to me is, you know, my immune system is weaker following treatment. So what can we do to reduce that exposure to infection? So thinking of what questions you want to ask, practicing out loud the conversation, whether it's you're walking in circles in a room, talking to yourself, or if you want to practice it with a friend. And then send an email agenda is what I would suggest to your employer before the meeting. So that way there's no surprises. They know what you're going to bring to the table. Mm. You then obviously have your meeting, and it's very difficult to take very thorough notes. I appreciate that. But I would take a few bullet point star notes on things you agree on. Mm-hmm. It might also be helpful to use, we all know, we hear about that cupboard of leaflets that people have of all the leaflets they receive throughout their treatment. It can actually be useful to use the leaflet to supplement the conversation. Mm. So, for example, I had a lady who had lymphedema, and she wanted to bring it up in conversation because she wanted to talk about reasonable accommodations, but she also didn't want to talk about it at length. She didn't feel very comfortable about it. So actually, I thought it was a nice idea. She gave the leaflet to her employer, explained, I have lymphedema. Here's some more information for you. And if you have any questions, come back to me, you know, afterwards. And it also gives the employer time to reflect on the symptom that they're describing.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's just a small, really simple thing. And because we know from the research that employers actually want to help, they want to support you, but they very often don't know how to. Mm. So it can educate them as well. And then the final thing, I suppose, would be after a meeting, I would always suggest send a meeting summary, preferably by email. You have it in writing and you have the agreed, you know, what you agreed during that meeting. So that can be quite helpful then. You have a record of it and they can come back to you if they think that, you know, there need to be a few amendments made to that. Mm. But really, first things first, if you haven't been in touch with your employer, I definitely recommend dropping them a quick line with a quick update.
We'll get back to that conversation in just a minute. I wanted to take a moment to talk to you about sun protection. As the temperatures begin to rise and we spend more time outdoors, make sure you have the correct protection for your family skin. Too much exposure to the sun's harmful rays can cause sunburn and skin damage. So before you head outdoors this summer, visit your local Care Plus pharmacy to check out a wide range of sun care products on offer. Now back to our conversation.
I think sometimes for people that can be the scariest thing, because like you said, when you're out of touch with your colleagues and your employers for so long, there can be such an anxiety, I think, for people for just sending that first message, because it's like, oh, I haven't spoken to them now in 6 months and I have to go back to work. And, yeah. And it can be terrifying for people. So I think that's a really good tip, just to keep in touch, even if it is just once a month. Mm.
But it puts a plan in place and it takes away that stress. I mean, you're under enough stress as it is. So the last thing you want is to be stressing about, when do I send an email or what do I do? So it's really, really good advice.
A cancer treatment can cause some cognitive changes. We hear people speak about chemo brain or brain fog. And as Dr. Connolly mentioned in our episode on fatigue, this can also cause cognitive changes. How can people manage these cognitive changes at work?
Yeah, so I suppose a lot of people don't realize that it's really common. And again, because it's one of those invisible side effects, they just try and get on with it. But actually, you don't have to just get on with it. It can be managed. But you're right, we can have the symptoms symptom cycle where one symptom can impact another. So if you think about it, if I'm really, really fatigued, if I'm just back from a night shift and I'm driving my car home and I'm so tired, obviously that's going to impact on my concentration and my cognition. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The same goes for anxiety. If I'm really, really overwhelmed about something, I'm not going to be thinking straight. So actually, a first protocol is thinking about all of our side effects and thinking about, well, you know, if I work on my fatigue, is that going to help with some of the cognitive changes? If I work on some of my maybe anxiety, might that also have a knock-on effect? In terms of probably the most common things I hear about cognitive changes in work, the most commonly reported things that come up with me are recalling colleagues' names. So going back to work and remembering the name, remembering every task on the to-do list, as well as concentration for long periods of time. So I'll give you a few strategies on each. In terms of the remembering names, first of all, if you're in a meeting and it's online, this is the beauty of Zoom. We can have the names up there. So what I'd always do is, oh, I'm just doing some housekeeping. Can I get everyone to update their names on the screen to make sure that they're up to date? So that's a small one and it's just for Zoom. Obviously, you can't get somebody to update their name in person. Yeah. So one of the tricks that we would do in cognitive rehab and OT is repetition. So when we are storing a memory in our head of someone's name, the more and more it's repeated, the more and more it kind of encodes and it stores in our longer term memory. So, for example, if I go into you and I say, hi, I'm Naomi. And you might say, oh, hi, Naomi. Nice to meet you. So by you saying that name again, it's repeating it and it hopefully it'll encode a little bit better. Another strategy is association. So this is when you learn of someone new, their name, and you try and think of something or someone that you can associate with that name. So, for example, I remember I used to have a patient on a ward and he couldn't remember anyone's names, and that was absolutely fine, but he could remember my name. And the reason he remembered my name is I'd walk down the ward and he'd say, oh, there's Naomi Campbell. And I am by no means Naomi Campbell, but he was able to associate my name with something familiar to him. Yeah. So whether it's, oh, hi, I'm John. Oh, hi, John. It's nice to meet you. I'm going to remember that now. My cousin is called John. So association can be a powerful one. Mm. We often have the first letter Qs. Now, this is a longer one, but going through the alphabet, does it start, does it prompt you to remember their name if it's somebody you've met before? I'd often encourage people, just ask a colleague, you know, give somebody a bit of an elbow bump there and say, what's their name again? Yeah. You know, get a trusted colleague that you can ask them, or just ask the person themselves, make a joke out of it, say, oh gosh, I've been gone so long, I've forgotten my own name. Mm-hmm. So that's a few bits on the remembering the names. In terms of the to-do list, we would often, the good news is that cognitive changes do get better over time. So that's a good thing. But in the meantime, we try and use compensatory strategies. So things like, you know, having a notebook, having a diary. I couldn't function without my diary. I just wouldn't remember to do things or be where I'm meant to be. Mm-hmm. Using the calendar or the diary on Outlook, for example, on your email, you're able to set a reminder that 15 minutes before a meeting, it'll notify you. You think, oh gosh, I have to go to that thing. I have to finish up on my task now. Setting alarms on your phone, that's quite helpful. Being consistent. So for example, if you know there's a certain meeting you have every month, keeping it maybe the first Monday of every month at the same time. So trying to keep consistency. Some people use their phone. Do you know the way you can do audio recordings? So if you need to remember something, or you've just had a meeting and you need to remember a few things, you didn't have the pen and paper, just record yourself very quickly in a quick note. I know one woman who used to use an actual dictaphone, but it's so easy now because we've got the phone now that does all these recordings for us. So
That's a really, really good idea. There's so many times I've sent Stephen voice notes because I'm just trying to remember it. And essentially he's like, what are you talking about? This is just for me to play back.
quite interested. And then the final piece is that concentration for long periods of time. You know, people talk about, well, after so long, I just can't process. And again, you know, we talk about this filter for people's thinking skills, and the more and more information that's coming at us, whether that's visual information, whether it's noise, whatever it is, the more and more information we get, the more clogged our filter gets, and it's less likely to process that information. So if you're able to reduce any visual distractions, whether, you know, you have a partition at your desk, whether you sit by a window, whether it's trying to reduce background noise cancelling headphones are great, moving to a quieter workspace if you can, earplugs, so reducing that type of thing, taking screen breaks. There's research that's just come out looking at if people, I think Microsoft did the research, and they were looking at four back-to-back 30-minute virtual meetings. And you can see they looked at the brain activity during the course of these meetings with no breaks. Mm-hmm. And you can see that the brain is getting completely overloaded during the second and third meetings, because there's been actually no mental break there. We talked about mental breaks before. So taking screen breaks. And then finally, I suppose a lot of people might have heard about the Pomodoro technique. Mm-hmm. You can download apps. I think a few of them are called Tomato Timers or Pomodoro. And this is where you time yourself to do 25 minutes of focused work, mm-hmm. and then you take a 5-minute break. So if you remember that mental fatigue, if you've been spending loads of time on a cognitively heavy task, you need to take that break. And that's where the Pomodoro technique comes in quite nicely.
I suppose moving on from that, you did touch off it a couple of minutes ago about like a side effects that patients may experience. And one being cognitive changes. We often hear people talk about chemo brain or fog brain. And I know we had a podcast recently with Dr. Connolly, who's an occupational therapist, and she mentioned about the four P's. And our listeners really responded really well to this. I suppose, would you mind just touching off the four P's and how people would be able to incorporate this into their working day if they're experiencing those side effects like foggy brain or chemo brain, as they say?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to recap on the four P's of energy management. So as Dr. Connolly had mentioned in her podcast, and I'd highly encourage everyone to listen to it, because it's a really good overview of cancer-related fatigue. But the four P's of energy management stand for planning, prioritizing, pacing, and posture or position. So from a planning point of view, and I'll give some strategies in the context of work, I would always suggest to plan to alternate heavy and light tasks. So in your day-to-day role. So what is a heavy task and what is a light task? If you think of a traffic light system, so if we think of the green, amber, and red, so your red tasks are things like you're really physically heavy, or they could be cognitively heavy. So really cognitively draining tasks. And you think of maybe the more medium tasks as amber, and lighter tasks. So say, for example, checking my email, that could be more of a green task. So I'd certainly recommend planning to alternate your heavy and light tasks so that you don't have back-to-back meetings in the morning, that you spread things out and you give yourself a bit more of a rest period in between. So for example, if you have a really important meeting scheduled at work, you might do lighter jobs before, like checking your emails or writing a quick note, something like that. If you know you're going to have a really, really busy day at work one day, try to plan to do very little the next day. And again, that kind of ties into pacing as well. Switching between physical tasks and cognitive tasks as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe planning the most difficult activity you'll have when you know you'll have most energy. Most people, and I don't know if there's scientific evidence on this, but most people I've spoken to typically have more energy in the mornings, and they find that they start to wane a little bit after lunchtime. So I suppose, you know, planning the most difficult activity when you know you're going to have the most energy. And I don't think I don't know if there's exact scientific evidence on this, but I typically find that people have most of their energy in the mornings, and it typically wanes then after lunchtime. So if you know that there's a really important item that you need to get done, doing it and planning it for the morning time. So thinking about your energy in that way. And again, planning the task, assembling all your items before starting a task. So again, thinking of that tea and coffee example. So it's bringing all your items together so that you're not going back and forth. And, you know, I suppose using your energy up in ways that that are wasteful. Mm-hmm. The next piece is prioritizing, asking yourself, do I need to do this today? Can it be done tomorrow? Yeah. That feeds into beginning with the most important task first. Mm-hmm. And also, do I have to do this? Is this something that I can delegate if necessary? Mm-hmm. And actually, do you know what? That feeds into the communication piece as well. A lot of people don't like asking for help. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Accept the help that's offered. Mm-hmm. If people offer you support when you first go back to work, if you keep saying no, they're going to assume that you're fine. So, you know, make the most of it. If you can delegate, great. If people are offering support, I'd say take it. Mm. So that's prioritizing piece. Pacing, so adding frequent rest breaks between activities. Stopping before you become overtired. A lot of people try to fight the fatigue.
Yeah.
And breaking up larger tasks into smaller segments. So, for example, you know, I have to write a 2,000 word report. Well, okay, I'm going to go and write 200 words now. So breaking it up, and then you have more, a bigger sense of achievement. You know, you can tick something off the list and you can do another 200 words again, the final piece, that posture piece, you save on average 25% of energy if you complete a task in sitting versus if you do it in standing. So that's from anything, even if you're at home and you say, for example, you're chopping vegetables, you're preparing the dinner. If you do it in sitting, you're actually going to save yourself more energy. And the same, it applies in the work context. Poor posture also consumes more energy. So if you think about it, if you're in a poor posture, your tummy muscles are working even harder to try and support your body. So maintaining that upright position, being supported by your chair as well. And again, avoiding that excessive bending, reaching, twisting, and stretching. So they're the four P's. But I think one last thing to note is the mental fatigue as well. So to try and reflect, when you're resting, are you really resting? Mm. So, for example, my current role is very screen-based. I'm constantly looking at a screen. If I am going on a break and I pick up my phone and I start scrolling, yeah, is that really switching off?
Mm.
So considering, are you making the most of your breaks? Are you switching off? And, you know, some people might like to use the Headspace apps or the Calm apps, so that guided meditation to really switch off. Some people like guided imagery. If you type in guided imagery into YouTube, it's usually somebody, you know, talks you through, depicts a scene, and you switch off and you go into another reality. Or what I quite like is box breathing. And it's something that you can use at work if you're feeling a bit anxious or overwhelmed, but no one knows you're doing it. So, you know, you don't have to be plugged into a guided meditation. You can simply breathe in for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds. And you repeat that cycle. It's called box breathing. So you breathe in for the same amount of time that you breathe out and hold. So definitely consider a few different strategies like that for your mental fatigue. And the other thing I'd say is, if you think about your thinking skills like a filter. So if we get lots of information coming in, the more and more information that comes in, the fuller the filter gets, and it's less able to process that information. Mm-hmm. So if you're able to get rid of some of the distractions, it makes your filter a bit more free, if that makes sense. Mm. So things like working in a quieter work environment, if you try noise cancelling headphones, things like that, they can, it can help you process information a bit easier.
Brilliant. Yeah, thank you so much. These are just such powerful tips. And I really think, especially like you said, with the breathing, you know, for anybody who's going back to work in an office, and like you said, you might not want to be obviously meditating in the office, but something as simple as the breathing. And we've had a few people mention that when it comes up to anxiety around scans as well, when you're sitting in the waiting room, you're waiting to go in for a scan or to get results, and it can be a particularly anxious time to focus on the box breathing. It can really help relax them.
Yeah,
that's great. So oftentimes we hear patients or employers suggest the 4 to 6 week return to work. Can you explain what a phased return to work actually looks like?
Yeah, I am forever hearing about the 4 week phased return or the 6 weeks. It's like the magical four week return, the magical 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And but that's not the reality after a cancer diagnosis. And it's just not realistic all the time. And don't get me wrong, there will have been people that 4 weeks or 6 weeks worked. But I like to discuss what I call the three principles of a phased return. So I think that the first principle is it's a review date, not a decision date.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is when you do return to work, instead of saying in 2 weeks' time, you know, I'm going to increase an extra day, instead, you know, what I would suggest is, sorry, can I actually start this back again?
Okay. Will I ask the question?
No, it's okay. I'll start from the first principle.
Perfect. Yep.
So I suppose the first principle would be it's a review date, not a decision date. So very often, you know, it's really about avoiding those formal goalposts that people set, because that's obviously going to put pressure on you. So I would consider your language. So instead of saying, you know, I'm going to go back to work in 3 months because you've set a goalpost there. Mm-hmm. Instead, you could try and say something like, I have a medical certificate for another 3 months. Closer to the time, I'll be in touch to review the situation following discussion with my medical team. Mm-hmm. And that immediately puts that pressure off you.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing as your phased return. So say you've gone back to work and, you know, your employer is saying, okay, in 2 weeks' time, you know, you're going to increase by a day. We'll say, no. Actually, in 2 weeks' time, let's sit down and review the situation. So it's a review date, not a decision date. But you're still giving your employer a date to work towards, because, you know, they kind of want to have a bit of a plan. Mm-hmm. So that's the first principle. The second principle is the staircase approach. So what that means is a phased return doesn't mean a consistent increase in hours over time. So when you make an increase in hours, so say, for example, I've returned to work and I'm working 2 days a week. You need to have a settling in period. You need to be able to reflect and think, is this sustainable? If you're feeling absolutely exhausted after, you know, the end of your working week, you know, maybe you need to spend a bit longer at that level of time. If you feel comfortable, and if you're not, you know, if you're not too fatigued, then you can have a gentle increase again. And an increase doesn't have to be a full day. It could be a half day increment either. So you could do the half day. And the final principle is consider working non-consecutive days. So very often I'll hear people working maybe 2 or 3 days in a row. So, and often the thought is that they can rest then for a long weekend. Mm-hmm. And that can work for some people, but I'll often suggest working maybe every second day. Mm-hmm. If they're finding that by their second or third consecutive day that they're really starting to struggle at work, they just can't concentrate, it's too fatiguing. And again, that feeds into the principle of pacing ourselves. So incorporating that rest period throughout the week. So maybe working the Monday, Wednesday and Friday, as opposed to the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Again, it's going to be trial and error for people. Mm-hmm. But certainly rule of thumb is a 4 to 6 week phase return isn't for everybody, and particularly after a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, I think that's great to hear, because sometimes I think it's really confusing for people. You know, they hear this 4 to 6, or we're going to increase in 4 weeks, but they're not ready. But this will actually, just even hearing this, will empower them to be able to have the conversation to say, no, actually, let's hang on. Can I actually just ask, so say, for instance, you mentioned it there, but there is somebody that starts off for 2 days and then they feel like, actually, I'm well able for this, I'm going to just up the hours. Like, would you advise them to go for it? Or do you think it's still wise to just slowly increase your hours?
Some people can be well able for it. And, you know, I've heard of a few people who go back near, you know, full time hours and might be a bit tired, but are actually able to cope with it.
Because I think that's another conflict I see, is somebody will say, oh, they only have me back 2 days, but I'm well able for it, but everyone's telling me to rest, and they don't know what to do because they feel okay, but their people are saying, you should be resting and taking it easy, you know?
Yeah, do you know what? Make the most of that time off.
Take
it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that'll never be a problem.
Well, a lot of people compare themselves to maybe other past employees who might have been out with cancer, and everyone's so different. Everyone's treatment is different. Everyone's, you know, cancer type is different. So you really shouldn't compare yourself to how others approach their return to work, because it's going to be different for everybody.
Yeah, and I suppose another thing is, like, sometimes people just, they feel okay, but they just don't know if they're ready to go back to work. Like, do you have any advice on how to, I suppose, understand if you're ready to go back to work or not?
Yeah, absolutely. So most people will never feel fully ready, because there's always going to be that unknown. You're not going to know until you go back into the role. But there are certainly things that you can do to assess your readiness, to try and dip your toes in and, and get an idea of, okay, am I as ready as I think I might be? And I would typically encourage people to try what I would call a job simulation. So basically scheduling a work day in your calendar. What I would do is I would maybe reflect on the type of tasks that you do in a typical work day, and plan that work day based on those type of tasks.
That's a very good idea.
Yeah. So for example, if you are in an office-based role and you're at the screen the whole time, or you do lots of typing. I had a lady a few weeks ago who, you know, I got her to do things like type up a report. I got her to do things like practice her commute. So I didn't actually make her drive to her workplace, but she went out in the car, did a drive the same length of time and came back, got into work in her home and started to do a number of the tasks that she would typically do, similar tasks that she would typically do as part of her role. And then afterwards to assess how she felt afterwards. So, you know, maybe you might want to schedule a half a day, or maybe you want to, you know, if you're feeling a bit more ambitious, schedule a full day of those type of roles, whether it's checking your emails. If you're in a more physical role, you know, can you do physical, can you simulate physical tasks that you would do as part of your normal job role? Can you physically do it? Can you cognitively do it? Can you emotionally and mentally do the role? So absolutely, I think if anyone is unsure, to try that job simulation and really, you know, schedule in that work day.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
And it takes out, I suppose, that anxiety of, like, the night before you go back to work, like, am I going to be completely overwhelmed? Am I going to be out of my depth? Like, you'll actually have a relative idea of whether you can or can't do it.
I'm laughing because I actually did this last week, because I had 2.5 weeks off work and I had the fear of going back in the early mornings, and I was only 2 weeks, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna set my alarm. So I got up at the weekend and set my alarm. So then the Monday when I came, I wasn't so stressed.
God, I'm so sorry. It worked.
Definitely work. And, like, that's 2 weeks. Imagine 6 months or 9 months or a year, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
And
what resources are available in Ireland to assist people with the return to work after cancer?
So resources are limited, but that doesn't mean that there's nothing out there. The Marie Keating Foundation have a lovely book. I know they print lots of hard copies of it, but you can get it online as a PDF, and it's called Back to Work After Cancer Guide. So there's information there for people who've had a cancer diagnosis, but also for employers. The Marie Keating Foundation actually also facilitate bespoke training workshops for employers. So it's worth checking out. I think it's the corporate workshop section of their website if you are an employer and you're not sure how to manage or navigate this type of return to work. They do offer that. The Irish Cancer Society have obviously just recently published their return to work report back in February. So we'll certainly be seeing more from them in the future, but they also do have a section on their website. I think it's your cancer diagnosis and work. So there is a section there for a little bit more information. I would always say, thinking more generally, we know that people need to try and be as physically and mentally fit and strong before they go to work. So the cancer support centres across Ireland, I cannot recommend them enough. They offer a suite of different programmes and workshops that can help you get back on track physically and mentally. So I'd certainly recommend that. I mean, I've facilitated a number of workshops on work and cancer for the cancer support centres, but I don't think it's a topic that is perhaps being presented nationwide. So there's a few select cancer support centres that are doing it, but not everyone. And then I suppose that the final piece is that, you know, every individual and every job role is so different. So sometimes you do need more tailored advice on how to navigate that return to work. You know, if we're worried about our strength and our endurance, we contact a physio. If we're worried about our mental health, we might go to a counsellor or a psychologist. And if you're worried about your ability to function in your job role or any activities of daily life, you should go to an occupational therapist. So if you're at the acute phase of treatment, you could ask if there's an OT on site, or you can link in with your GP as well, who should be able to refer you to an OT in the community.
Brilliant. And I'm just thinking that they're all really, really good resources. Is there any funding available for people who think, right, I kind of need to see a physio or something like that? Are they best to access them through the hospitals or privately, or what's the best way normally for people, do you think?
There are private services, but obviously that costs money.
That's what I'm thinking. People who are out of work for a long time and money might be tight, and they're trying to think, right, I recognize I need this, but I wonder what's the best way of going about it.
What I would say is, if you are in a position to afford it, you could contact a private practitioner. So for example, a private OT you can find on the AOTI website, which is our professional body, and that they have a list of private OTs. But otherwise, what I would suggest is trying to get a referral through your hospital if you are in the acute phase of treatment, or through your GP. So your GP can often refer you to the local primary care centre, where there's often OTs there. And you know, the wait lists are going to differ depending on the region as well, so it's really difficult to say how soon you would see someone. But you know, or if you're in a hospital where there isn't, for some reason, an OT on the oncology unit, asking, well, why not? So there's definitely ways. You don't have to go privately, and there's definitely ways to facilitate that. But again, what I would say is, you know, accessing your local cancer support centres as well, because a lot of their programmes are free. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I do a bit of OT work with some of the cancer support centres. So there is sometimes some OT input there, not always. So it's just doing a bit of investigation work and digging.
Yeah. I think, like you said, those cancer support centres can't speak highly enough for some of the things that they run. They're brilliant. And do you see people, if somebody is listening and they're thinking, you know, I've gone to this person and that person, I haven't quite got the answers that I'm looking for, do you see patients yourself, Naomi?
Yeah, so I do work privately at a private capacity as an OT. So I do have my details on the AOTI website. I suppose I'm seeing less and less people at the moment. I'm at the final stages of the PhD, but I am certainly still seeing a handful of people, particularly in the area of going back to work after cancer.
Perfect. Brilliant. Now, listen, thank you so much. It's great to have you on, because you're just, I suppose, when you're in that world, like, you think of things that we would just never, ever, ever think of. Like, so useful and practical. But like you say, you just don't think of them. And they're simple, really, and can be implemented. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And for all the work that you've put in for cancer patients and helping people return to work. Like, we're so blessed that there's people like you working in this area and dedicating all of your education to it and all your work to it. Like, thank you so much. It's really going to help so many people, Naomi.
Well, thank you. Thank you for providing the platform as well, that we can speak about things like this. So it's great to have, you know, podcasts like this much more accessible for not just healthcare professionals, but, you know, most importantly for those with a cancer diagnosis.
Absolutely. And actually, Dr. Connolly's podcast is one of our most listened to podcasts.
When we went on to early AM, Tommy Bo was like, the 4 P's, and we were like,
I'll have to tell her that.
He's like, I listened to Dr. Connolly and I know all the 4 P's, and he was like, planning, positioning.
We were like, well, if I wasn't nervous before. It's just funny the things that resonate with people. And I think because again, it's such a simple thing, the 4 P's, like, people can just relate to it.
I think as well, like, fatigue, it's one of those invisible kind of symptoms, you know, so it's overlooked an awful lot. So it got massive attraction. So I think this one is going to help so many people, because it's brought up so much, but there's just, the answers just don't seem to be there. So this is brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at @theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.